This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Schools have reopened this month, but how did the school closures, which disrupted learning for about 5 million children here in Malaysia, impact our most vulnerable children? Why is getting them back into school a priority? So on this penultimate episode of our series, in collaboration with the folks behind the Buka Sekolah Kami campaign, we're going to look at how school closures have impacted both special needs children and also children from dysfunctional homes, and basically all those children in need. And joining me to discuss this and more are Azlina Kamal. She's a UNICEF education specialist in Malaysia, and Chan Sun Seng, who is the CEO for Teach for Malaysia. Welcome, both of you. How are you today?
Hi, Juliet.
Good to be here, Juliet.
Lovely to have you both on the show. So yes, we've done several episodes in this series already. This is our second last episode. You know, we've looked at different things like impact on children's physical health, their mental health. So today we want to focus specifically on, you know, how it affected those who are underprivileged, right? Or who are less privileged in some way or vulnerable in some way. Before we get to that though, Azlina, maybe I can start with you. Can you tell me a little bit about your role in UNICEF? I know you work closely with the MOE, with the Ministry of Education, and also other stakeholders to ensure all children have access to quality, equity and inclusion in education. Am I correct?
Perfectly put. I don't think I have anything to add. You summarized my
job description
role perfectly.
But I mean, how would you describe that? I mean, like, you know, especially during these times, you know, I'm certain it's been an extra challenge, you know, these past 2 years especially.
Yeah. So basically, you know, what we look at, especially, I lead the education section in the office, and we look at strategic development and implementation of education programs. And that includes all the education response during COVID. So essentially, we're looking at a two-pronged approach of system strengthening. So looking at, like you said earlier, you know, accelerating innovation, leveraging on government and private sector partnerships, for example. Looking at data strengthening, advocacy. And also the other prong is to make sure that we ensure equity and inclusion, especially for children who are most marginalized and disadvantaged and excluded in our society.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I mean, you know, that's the reason why we're going to be talking about this with you as well. But before that, Sun Seng, you of course are the CEO for Teach for Malaysia. You're also a TFM alumni. I mean, we caught up many years ago, and you were just on the show recently as well, talking about it. And I know that during your time as a teacher, you witnessed the challenges faced by students growing up in low-income communities. And, you know, all of this was even pre-COVID times, and it wasn't great even then, was it?
Yeah, Juliet, it's good to, once again, it's good to be here. You know, I think when, not I think, but really before the pandemic, there have been existing inequities in the system. And, you know, one of the things that Malaysia has done well as a country that has rapidly developed is that we have been able to provide universal access to students largely, right, through the physical presence of school. But then there have been challenges in terms of the quality of education that students have actually received across this time, right? And we've seen that, you know, there are many lines of divide, right, whether that's the urban-rural divide, whether that is the income class divide. And so different things that that divide children and their access to a quality of education have existed. And there has been, you know, significant efforts and a need to address those things, you know, which the Ministry of Education has been working hard to address, and is why Teach for Malaysia exists in the first place, right? We want to ensure that every child in Malaysia, no matter what their background, has the opportunity to attain a quality education, right? And I think that what we've seen with COVID-19 is that you know, a lot of the existing inequities and new ones have come to light, and that's really come to the forefront of some of the biggest challenges we see as a nation. But these are not things, and I know that Azlina will agree with me, these are not things that did not exist. Many of these things are not things that did not exist before. And as we look forward, you know, we really need to ensure that we're addressing the challenges that, you know, COVID-19 has presented, as well as challenges that have existed in the past.
Okay, all right. And I guess, you know, the whole point of this campaign actually was for schools to reopen, and schools have reopened, which is wonderful news, right? But, you know, we're talking about the policies. Those have varied significantly, you know, especially here across the world. Why do you think our response, this response to school closures has differed so greatly? You know, why do you think the reasons are for Malaysia's prolonged and also all these sort of blanket school closures that we had? Azrina, you want to go first?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, I'll say that, you know, we recognize that there have been differences in terms of how messages have been communicated. And we know that, you know, people are getting a plethora of information, being bombarded with all sorts of information, news, updates on social media, etc. And there has been this prevalent discourse for the past 1.5 years that everybody needs to stay at home, right? So understandably, parents are genuinely concerned about their children's safety. But when you look at the findings and the data, these common concerns about school reopening, that children will catch infection, bring it home, and then outbreaks or clusters will happen again. I think the data shows us that COVID-19 among children is not at all common and less severe. And so the severity of the cases also only increases with age, right? So if you look at data, WHO recently presented the data, if you're looking at children below 18, the severity of the cases is very much reduced rather than adults, for example. And they are not big spreaders, and so not a big risk of outbreaks if transmission rate in the local community is low. So there is this risk benefit favoring reopening of schools, especially when we look at the younger classes. And this is also important educationally, because we know that, you know, a strong foundation in the early years is very important for children to succeed in later life, in every aspect of life, right? Not just academically, but also emotionally, in terms of future earnings, etc. So what is most important is really the public health and social measures, yeah, the vaccination rates, and how we prepare for the safe reopening and operation of schools. And UNICEF, for example, we have multiple tools, resources that we've worked on. Even before mass school closures, we've had, you know, guidance on how to prevent and control COVID, in spread of COVID in schools. During school closures, we've had all sorts of resources, and also even on school reopening and how we can now recover education system. But I just wanted to highlight this, right? In short, we've used a health argument to close things and an economic argument to open things up. Yeah. The question then is, what about the education of our children? Is that not a compelling enough argument, right? So it's always between health, economic. And what does it say about us as a society if we prioritize, say, for example, the opening of entertainment centers, but not schools? So are we saying the entertainment centers are more important, for example, right? And so definitely we welcome this decision to reopen schools, because we think it is absolutely critical to address the learning losses among children, and the time to act is now. Mm-hmm. Because as Sun Sing mentioned, school closures are exacerbating an existing learning crisis.
Mm-hmm. They've definitely exacerbated. And Sun Sing, how do you feel about that? You know, what do you think about all of these blanket closures? You know, why do you think Malaysia perhaps, you know, went with that sort of way of tackling this?
Yeah, you know, Juliet, when COVID-19 hit, you know, there was no government in the world that knew what to do with their education systems, right? Nobody had the right answer, right? And everyone was really taking a bet on what would work, right? And I think that Malaysia at the time made the right choice to take the most cautious choice possible. And if we look at how Malaysia handled the pandemic in the very early stages, Malaysia was a massive success story, right? And I think that the challenge has been with the prolonged management and whether we've been able to sustain that effectively over time, right? But with regards to school closures in the initial stages, nobody knew what to do. And, you know, I think it made sense at the beginning that we had these blanket school closures. And, you know, as the Ministry of Education, the ministry needs to take into account what is actually happening on the ground, and they need to be able to gather all of the data from across the states, from across schools, from schools all the way up to the federal level, in order to begin making informed decisions. And at the very early stages, you know, closing down schools made a lot of sense. I think the challenge has been the fact that the school closures have been so prolonged, and we've seen that obviously in relation to how the pandemic has hit Malaysia in multiple waves, right? And, you know, we've had, fortunately, we're coming, the numbers are going down, we're looking like we're coming out of this, and I think that we're very fortunate for that. But, you know, we were at really, really high rates, right, worldwide in terms of our infection rates at one point. And so there's, I can understand the sense to want to be conservative in the way that we make decisions. But I think that I'm grateful that schools are opening. We should have opened them earlier, is my opinion. And by this year, we would have already had the data to make more informed decisions about how to reopen schools. And I think that even as we move forward and we think about the readiness or the resilience of our system to continue to respond to when or when schools shouldn't be open, how do we respond to crises? We've got to think more about how do we move away from just these blanket centralized decision-making to a more decentralized approach, where we're empowering schools and local communities to figure out how to do this with considering all of the relevant information and different parties from the Ministry of Health, from the local public health officials as well. But I really do think that we need to, even now the school reopening plans are a very central. It's a very centralized plan. We do need to decentralize that further.
I was actually going to ask you that, you know, I mean, what are your thoughts on this whole, the whole plan for reopening, right? Because we're going to be doing it according to phases of the NRP, right? What are your thoughts on that? Sun Seng, you want to go first? Sorry, since you were already on that.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, I mean, I think that to what Aslina was saying, right? Karaoke centers opened in Malaysia, and cinemas opened in Malaysia before schools opened in Malaysia. And when we look at what Aslina was saying around the data, we see that school closures haven't been, and if you look across the world, school closures haven't been proven largely to be effective measures at controlling the spread. So meaning that basically if you close schools down or if you open schools down, they weren't the thing that was spreading COVID, right? We've kept our factories open. We've kept a lot of businesses open. And many of those things have actually been causing the continued spread of COVID. But the data is showing us that in studies in different countries around the world, that schools remaining open actually don't cause that spread, right? And so we could have opened them earlier, really. And I think that really moving forward, how do we accelerate that, right? Mm. And so it's a very cautious reopening plan, which I think makes sense for Malaysia's current sentiment at this point in time. But I think ultimately what we need to be able to do is trust and empower schools and local governments to reopen schools appropriately, and also give parents the choice. I think that that's really important, right? Like if a parent doesn't feel safe sending their child back to school because, and they have an environment at home in which their children can learn effectively online, there are some families that do have that. We should give them the choice to be able to do that. And many, many of our teachers have been upskilled and are a lot more familiar now with home-based learning, with distance learning. And so how do we provide options that do give choice, more choice to school leaders and to local communities and parents?
Yeah. And Azlina, how about you? How do you feel about it?
I really think that, you know, time is really of the essence, right? Because we know that, you know, the irreversible harm of prolonged school closures on the cognitive and social-emotional development of children, the psychosocial impact, as well as the well-being of children. And so essentially what we're looking at, and UNICEF came up with this report of the lost COVID generation, right? So yeah. The future of an entire generation of children is at stake. Yeah. You know, and the disruptions to our education system since early 2020 has driven substantial losses and inequalities in learning. And of course, it disproportionately affects the most marginalized children. And you mentioned earlier in your introduction that more than 5 million children in Malaysia have lost instructional time. And so while efforts, you know, we've been really lucky. We've had the online learning platform, you know, to provide remote instruction and learning. And this is laudable, right? But there have also been severe challenges to digital access and inclusion. And we know from a survey that MOE did, 36% of children in urban areas and 35% of children in rural areas have no access to any type of gadget or devices. Yeah. And I think globally, we've also seen situation of children with increased digital divide and child poverty. And even when children have access to devices, it cannot substitute the benefits of in-person learning that children receive in schools, right? So all these relationships that they build in school with their teachers, that social aspect of learning is also very important. And even more concerning for a lot of us is that many children, even when schools reopen, may not return to school, given all the deprivations that they are experiencing. So I always tell people, right, at the center of this pandemic, if you think about it, there is a child who is poor or who was poor to begin with, whose parents have lost their jobs, who probably may or may not have a disability, who now has to take care of younger siblings or now have to partake in, you know, getting jobs to supplement the income of the family, who doesn't have access to any gadgets, whose school is closed or really far away from home, even say internet centers are really far. So, you know, what is the opportunity for this child, right? There are multiple layers of challenges and deprivation. And so it's not just going to be automatic when we open schools that the most marginalized children, layers and levels of marginalization is just going to pick themselves up and then just go back to school, right? So, so these are things because we know the inequalities, the inequities, like we said earlier, you know, everything has been magnified. It's been there before. It's now further magnified. And also, you know, World Bank came out with this report to say that school closures and the resulting disruptions to school participation and learning, projected losses are valued at $10 trillion globally, right, in terms of affected children's future earnings. And one more thing that I wanted to also highlight, schools are not just places where children go to learn and do well in exams, for example, right? It also plays a critical role in ensuring delivery of essential health services, nutritious meals, protection, psychosocial support. And very often, right, the most marginalized children rely on these services provided by school. And so, you know, with school closures, it's also imperiled children's overall well-being and their development, not just their learning. And multiple reports, right, tell us that, you know, girls are even more at risk of not returning to school as a result of this disruption. Like globally, 61,000 girls are, you know, additionally at risk on top of not going back to school, additionally at risk of child marriage, for example. And, you know, nearly 120,000 girls are at risk of adolescent pregnancy across the East Asia Pacific region because there's a correlation with school closures. And then, you know, as we said earlier about increased child poverty, so children will live in income poor households as a direct effect of the benefit. And And also, you know, more children will likely be engaged in child labor by the end of 2022. So all these things, right, all this collectively will impact on the future of our children, right? So while we go on this back and forth health economic considerations, I think we need to really pay attention about, you know, the losses. You know, the child that could have been that child without COVID is a very different child. Having experienced COVID and all the disruptions in their life as a result, right? And we did this program where we wanted to hear from young people and children with our partner, MOE and AROS. And we found out that, you know, children are really, it's having an impact, not just on their emotional well-being. We've also had children talking about suicide and feeling really depressed because, you know, their entire life has been,
upended almost, yeah.
Exactly, right? And so for all these reasons, right, we really need to look at school reopening. And I think, you know, looking at schools, like Sun Sing said, schools should be able to decide. We have a lot of materials on checklists, what schools need to be mindful of, you know, looking at safe reopenings. We've worked with UNESCO and World Bank on this. And, you know, it's very detailed, very clear. Schools should be able to make this decision. And a one-size-fits-all approach is not going to work, right? So if you have a state that only has 2 cases of COVID, and yet all children are not going to school, there's no real reason why that should be. And so I think re-evaluating that, looking at targeted interventions, looking at data, and having a more nuanced and targeted approach to school reopening will be very, very important.
Yep. Yeah, and Juliet, I'll give you an example of that, right? Sarawak has had a high number of cases in recent times, and growing even, but it has also been the only long time that has had districts that are green zones.
Yeah.
And so to make a blanket wide nationwide and then even a statewide decision is really disadvantaging kids who could truly safely go back to school at this point in time.
Yeah, definitely. And we're just going to go for a quick break now. But when we come back, we're going to talk a bit more about, you know, how we need to move away from decentralization and, you know, what might be done, what we can do better, I suppose, in the Malaysian context. I'm speaking today to Azlina Kamal. She is the UNICEF Education Specialist in Malaysia, and also Chan Sun Seng. He's the CEO for Teach for Malaysia. We're talking about school closures and how it has impacted vulnerable children. I mean, the good news is, of course, schools have reopened, but, you know, we need to get rid of these blanket policies. You know, we need to look for, as Azlina said, targeted interventions. So we're going to discuss why that's important after this quick break. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the line today are Azlina Kamal. She's a UNICEF Education Specialist in Malaysia, and Chan Sun Seng, who is the CEO for Teach for Malaysia. This is part of our Buka Sekolah campaign, and we're talking about school closures and the impact on vulnerable children. Of course, the good news is, as we keep saying, schools have reopened, but, you know, it's going according to phases. Not everyone is back in school. So we're talking about what policies are in place, what policies should be in place, and, you know, how we need targeted interventions and not blanket policies. You know, before the break, we were talking about all the different impacts on children, you know, and how this is really going to impact them in the long term, and how we need decentralized solutions. Can we look at what's happening across the world, right? I mean, are there sort of best practices or policies that you know from other countries that we can do? You know, I mean, are there some that have done exceptionally well, perhaps, in minimizing school closures? You know, is that possible for us as well? Azlina, you want to go first?
Yes, thank you so much, Juliet. So I'll kind of share from 2 different perspectives, right? So we're now working towards this mission recovering education, keeping in mind all the learning loss. So UNICEF, UNESCO and World Bank. And so there have been 5 key lessons that we've learned under this mission recovering education, right? So leadership is essential. And a good example of this, we have Sri Lanka, where they set up an interministerial task force to look at, you know, effectiveness of responses towards COVID. The second being teacher engagement, and Lao PDR and Malaysia have been really strong in terms of looking at supporting teachers and building their capacity when it comes to blended learning. The third, spotlighting gender and marginalization. So we talked a little bit about this earlier in the program where, you know, focusing on the most marginalized children is the most essential. And countries like, say, Madagascar, for example, have done quite a bit on, you know, focusing on adolescent girls and making sure that they come back to school, for example. Ghana also, you know, focusing on girls' education. Turkey, for example, have had outreach campaigns for refugee and vulnerable learners. The fourth that we've learned is data and understanding impact. Nigeria, for example, they've got community learning hubs so that children can go and, you know, have revision and also looking at accelerated learning programs. Brazil, for example, they have this school active search program where they, you know, work towards bringing back every child to school. And the last lesson is on innovation. And we know countries like, say, for example, Uruguay have worked on this online system. Same with Jordan, looking at Learning Bridges program to kind of accelerate learning, looking at online and offline options, right, for children. And I can go on a bit more and also share, for example, like when it comes to reopening in ASEAN, Vietnam has been really the speed of response to the pandemic. You know, looking at establishing effective health structures, for example, to look at cross-sectoral preparedness. And that's something that is really important, right? We can't just work within our own sectors. Yeah. I think looking at cross-sectoral responses and preparedness is very important. So looking at, for example, healthcare, nutrition, education, etc. In terms of equitable and quality access, Indonesia has this learning from home program, both as an online and offline alternative to attending school, where they even have, like, in remote areas, you know, people going for home visits to make sure children are learning. Timor-Leste, you know, they've got this learning passport platform, which is with accessible format in terms of audio interactive elements to engage children with disabilities. And even our country, Malaysia, we've done really well to also look at large scale online teacher training. Mm. Our Community Guru Digital Learning has been, you know, used as an example of a promising practice out of 147 countries. It's been cited as a global case study. So that's also something to celebrate when it comes to that. We worked with the Ministry of Education and ARUS on that. And also, you know, Lao PDR, Cambodia, looking at small local clusters to help teachers in remote areas. So I'll stop there in case Sinsing wants to give some example as well. Yeah, there are a lot of examples of good practices. This is the thing about COVID, right? Well, it's given us enormous challenges. It's also given us a lot of opportunities to innovate and to build back better. So that's been really encouraging as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so, Juliet, I think, you know, there are many more forms in which we could reopen schools actually during this time. You know, the Ministry of Education has announced some a rotational system, right? Where some of the kids will go to school and then some will learn from home and then they switch and take turns. But there are actually many, many other ways in which we can ensure that more kids go back to school and we're able to have kids coming back to school. So different forms of that. But I think that what I'd say is a key thing, you know, schools are reopening, you know, What a key thing that we need to invest in now is really what is our plan for not just reopening schools, but for recovering education at this time. And, you know, Azina referred to the Mission Education Recovery, which UNICEF, UNESCO and the World Bank have. It's a strategy that they've put in place. And Malaysia has announced an education recovery strategy up till the end of this year, up till the end of this schooling year. So February 2022. But we need a much, much stronger plan in terms of the long-term effects of this of the learning loss at this point in time, right? Not just the academic learning loss, but all of these factors that Azina's talked about that education supports, right? The holistic development of a child. And I think that what we need to recognize is that it's not just getting kids back to school, but dealing with learning loss and education recovery is going to be a multi-year issue. It's going to affect most of these children for their entire lifetime, and it's going to be a long-term investment. And that's really where we need to be focusing, I believe, our efforts at this point in time. Do we have a strong plan to support kids? And you know, and it's really thinking, how are we ensuring that as kids come back, we're getting the data about where they are at, right? We're understanding what the learning loss looks like in the Malaysian context. And we're making decisions based on that, and that schools are empowered to make decisions to address the learning needs, whether that's academic learning needs, whether that is socio-emotional learning needs of a child, based on the data that they're getting. And I think a challenge in Malaysia is that we're so used to sort of collecting data sort of for a national kind of high stakes test or for very centralized policy decision making. And so how do we then empower schools to be able to use data to make decisions about how to support their kids at this point in time, whether it's with regards to the learning loss or just whatever kids need at this point. So I really think that that's the next stage of the conversation. You know, as schools reopen, what does our education recovery plan look like in Malaysia?
Yeah, and what plan puts the child at the center of it, right? It's not about all the other things, like you said, Azina, the economics or anything like that. What is best for our children? What is best to make up for all those losses? What is best to get them back on the road to whatever it is that they need to achieve, isn't it? And I don't think that's happening at the moment.
Yeah. And I would echo and say that really, while we're talking about school reopening, it is absolutely critical, right, for all the reasons we've talked about earlier, but it is definitely not enough, right? So mm-hmm. we all will need to prioritize and ensure not just that all kids are back in school, and again, you know, using data and identifying who is not back and why and how do we support that. Also to look at, you know, how schools can reopen safely, and also in terms of children receiving tailored and sustained remedial learning, right, and comprehensive services to help them readjust and catch up. And I also wanted to bring up the point, right, children are going to come back to school with all sorts of trauma. They've lost loved ones, parents or family members who have died as a result of COVID, for example, who have fallen ill, and we're going to have children come back to school with all this trauma, right? And so, how we support children, not just in terms of catching up with all the learning that they've lost, but also in terms of helping them cope with all this, trauma and emotional issues. I think then looking at how we support teachers to be able to address all those learning losses then becomes absolutely critical as well. So I think, you know, first of all, schools need to open for all the reasons. And then when schools open, we need to then look at, you know, how schools cope with children coming back, how we help teachers to be able to then support that as well as part of that long-term project of the recovery plan.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up the teachers. Sunseng, I'm wondering about, you know, the teachers from Teach from Malaysia as well. How have, you know, what have they been seeing? You know, how have they been responding to the students' needs? You know, what stories can you share?
Yeah, you know, it's really, you know, I think Azania mentioned this just now as well. It's really leadership at this point in time that will make the difference, right? Because we are in a situation where nobody knows all the answers.
Yeah.
There's no one who has the right answer. And what we need is as many leaders who are as close to the ground as possible, who understand the needs and are then thinking of innovative solutions to be able to address those needs. A big challenge, obviously, during this time has been that even getting in touch with students mm-hmm. to understand their challenges and their needs has been a big issue. But I think that, you know, what we've seen is that we've needed to really support our teachers. And you know, as Anita was talking about, how do we support our teachers to address the learning loss? We've needed to train them to retrain and retrain them multiple times, right? How do we deliver distance learning during this point in time? What is your role as a teacher to help support a child's mental health and emotional well-being during this period of time? How are your lessons changing to ensure that you're not just delivering academic content, but you're creating space for students to share and talk about their challenges and their problems? You know, this is always, issues of issues that are existing now have always existed, but I'll share a story. And this is not a new thing, but it is something that we're seeing more and more of, which is extremely unfortunate. We had a student that came into a lesson after weeks of not turning up, came into a lesson and then as the lesson was ending, contacted our teacher and told the teacher that, you know, they wanted to speak to that teacher, and discovered that this student hadn't been attending because they were just living in a really unsafe environment. There was domestic violence that was going on, and they didn't know what to do, and they couldn't come to school. And, you know, fortunately, we were able to hear about that and support them through different professional services that were able to help them. And they were then able to, the mother of the child was then able to take action, move out of the house and come into a safer environment. But there are this is just an anecdotal story. It's not a new thing, but it is on the rise. We have seen that, you know, the data shows that domestic violence is on the rise and more of these cases are happening. So even more so, the burden on teachers is immense at this point in time. And how are we, I think the key question that we're asking is, how are we supporting our teachers with the knowledge and skills to be able to address all of the challenges, but also on top of just the technical training, how are we developing the leadership for them to be able to respond and innovate during this period of time? And I think that that's going to be a key thing, right? You know, even as we say that we need an education recovery plan, you're not going to be able to create a five-year plan that completely is exhaustive and is going to address all of the issues. Yeah. We're going to have to be agile. We're going to have to be responsive and address the needs as they come. And what we're going to need in Malaysia is just a lot more empowered leadership on the ground, and shifting away from our very centralized system to just more empowered local leaders.
Mm-hmm. Azlina, would you agree with that? You know, I mean, what sort of investments do you think we need to make now in our education system to ensure that we all have a safe return to physical school for all students, and, you know, that it's done well, I suppose, you know, with children at the heart of it?
Yeah, I think, you know, we are also looking at this, like there are six critical areas, right? So like you say, you know, ensuring that all children will be able to learn and, you know, closing the digital divide will be absolutely critical in this. So that work needs to continue happening, right? So this is not going to be the last of the shocks to our education system.
Yeah.
We anticipate future shocks. And so this is why we say it's also an opportunity to kind of build back better and say, okay, what were the cracks before, which have been, magnified as a result of COVID, and how do we then work together to make sure that we address all these issues. So the first being, we need to work together to make sure children are able to learn, we close the digital divide. The other is also, you know, guaranteeing access to health and nutrition services, how we make vaccines affordable and available to every child. That's also important. Because again, right, all the marginalization, the ones who need access the most are the ones who usually don't get access. Looking at mental health is really going to emerge as one of the key issues, mental health of children, young people, you know, looking at issues related to abuse, gender-based violence, neglect, for example, in adulthood, on top of all the other mental health issues that children are going on and I talked about earlier. The other also looking at, you know, hygiene, environmental degradation and climate change. That's also going to be critical and important. and how do we then reverse the rise in child poverty so that we ensure a more inclusive recovery for everybody? And last but not least is to look at, you know, how do we help or redouble efforts to support children and families living through displacement and also as a result of COVID, right? Because we know a lot of families whose parents have lost jobs and they've had to move because they cannot maintain the life they had before. And so there's a lot of internal displacements for children as well, which is also going to impact their learning and their well-being. So these are some of the areas and plans that we are urging, you know, governments, partners, even UNICEF is investing in to work together with all stakeholders.
Mm-hmm. Sunsing, anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that that's a really comprehensive investment, right? And I think that one of the things that Azlina said, which I think is important to highlight, right, is that is building the resilience of the system. Mm. You know, when we were around this time last year, we didn't think that schools were going to be closed for this amount of time the following year, right? Mm. And I think it's really about continuous investment in the resilience of our system. You know, we've invested in rolling out devices through a pilot program that needs to continue. We need to continue to ensure that there's connectivity, the digital inclusion piece. So basically all of that needs to be a sustained effort over the next couple of years. You know, we're going to experience the economic shock. We are experiencing the economic shock of COVID. We are also experiencing the shock of the education system, but that is going to come out in a much longer term way. And we're going to see much more sustained damages from that really in the longer term. And so I think that we really just need to keep our eyes on the long-term investment of education recovery, not just about getting kids back to school is step one, yeah. But for the years to come, we're going to need to sustain our investments in education.
And just to add to what Sunsing was saying as well, I think, you know, investing in all these multiple pathways to secondary education and skills development, I think will be important because, again, right, there's all this micro-credentialing, you know, how do we look at, you know, different marginalized groups that maybe will not suit a very rigid kind of, you know, you need to go and have your lessons how many times a week at whatever time, right? So looking at more flexible pathways to skills development, I think will also be another opportunity for us to work together. So we're really also, you know, looking forward to see what are those areas in which we can, you know, as a result of the pandemic, emerge as new areas that we should all be investing in the long term.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're talking about all these different stakeholders as well, right? And how do you see them all playing a role, or what roles do you think they should play actually in ensuring that schools can, you know, reopen safely and also remain open consistently? I suppose, you know, that's the end game as well, right?
Yeah, I think all I will say, I think I've shared some of those things earlier. And, you know, education is not just the business of the government, of schools. I think if anything, right, we've become really cognizant to the fact that education is everybody's business, right? Everybody is responsible for children's education. And we know this, right, with COVID, parents are suddenly, you know, becoming teachers, trying to cope with their children's online learning. And, you know, so I think, you know, that's also another opportunity to say that, look, we're all responsible. And UNICEF Indonesia has this beautiful tagline that I really love that says, "Kerana kita semua adalah ibu bapanya." All of us are the parent of every child, right? And so as duty bearers, we all have a duty to ensure that, you know, children are in school, they learn, no matter who they are, where they come from, who their parents are, whether they have document or not. These are all things which are part of the, you know, the right to an education in the conventions on the right of the child, right? So, and I think we've talked about a lot of the different areas. I think, you know, we should seize the opportunity. It's a once in a generation or a lifetime opportunity for us to reimagine education for every child, right? And so I think you know, we should all work together towards that. And yeah, UNICEF is looking forward. We've worked on quite a number of different things, like global citizenship education to address remediation. You know, I talked about community guru digital learning. We've got future skills for all. Again, we don't work on our own. We work with the ministry. We work with our partners. You know, and we have really fantastic partners who work with us on all the different programs. And so we are looking forward to working with other partners as well on all the different areas we've talked about.
Okay. And Sun Seng, you know, you guys work a lot with many, many different stakeholders. What any last message you'd like to leave us with regard to that?
Yeah, you know, I really agree with what Azlina was saying. And, you know, the very, very typical education quote, right, that it takes a village to raise a child. And we've seen at this point in time, you know, especially if you're a parent at home with kids, the importance of being involved, right? And I think that it's really about how do we sustain the efforts now, right? I think that that teachers have had to communicate with parents in a very, very different way than they've had before. But how do we sustain that, right? How do we not just go back to school and revert back to the way that things were in the past and revert to some of the things that weren't working, right? Azlina's used the term to build back better, right? How do we do that, right? Build back better, build forward differently. How are we being intentional about that and as a community coming together? You know, Teach for Malaysia has been very, very privileged to have many partners and supporters. And what we've seen during this time is that our partners and supporters have really stepped up, right? Whether that's corporate supporters, whether that is individuals, people who want to volunteer their time, people have stepped up to the challenge during this time and have been even telling us, hey, what more can we do, right? But really to what I said earlier, it's about the sustained multi-year effort that is really going to make the difference. And so how do we continue that? How do we sustain that over the years to come? That's the opportunity that we have, right? Like, as we go back to school, it's to not go back to a system that was perpetuating some of the inequities that existed. How do we go back to a system and rebuild that system and build that system to a system that works for all kids, right? And have that really as a conscious and intentional and sustained effort.
Yeah, because we, like you said, we are. Sorry,
and just to finish up on that as well, I think you know, we need to. I love what Sun Seng said, but also to just add that, you know, we need to, there's some gaps, right? As we are building back better, we need to consider how do we reach and include the most marginalized children? How do we measure, assess, and monitor learning achievements? And how do we identify what works and scale them up?
Yep.
And ultimately, how do we strengthen the system for sustainability and resilience? So, and underpinning this is innovation, flexibility, looking at improved equity and learning, climate change adaptation, and also, you know, as part of that system resilience. So I think that's going to be really, really important.
Yeah, it's going to be some very crucial years ahead of us, actually. So yeah, a sustained effort and, you know, collaboration. I think that's also the most important thing here, right? Everybody needs to get involved. Well, I'm afraid we're running out of time, but my thanks to the both of you for joining me today. I've been speaking to Azlina Kamal. She's the UNICEF Education Specialist in Malaysia, and Chan Sun Seng, who's the CEO for Teach for Malaysia. If you miss any part of our conversation, you can download the podcast at bfm.my/learn, or you can find it on the BFM app. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.